So, there were a lot of things that we actually covered with the four speeches that we had today. I think at this point of time in the UK, mindfulness, meditation, it's all a buzz, and everyone is about it. So you hear it on radio stations, on BBC, it's everywhere. And the big question is, can you actually sort of practice mindfulness and keep to the whatever the practice that is taught in the training of mindfulness, and also practice or be living in the faiths that you believe or have no faith whatsoever? What do you think, Achan?
Well, if I remember correctly, the Buddha pointed out that as long as a person's practice contained all the different elements of the Eightfold Path, then that could lead to liberation. If it didn't contain all those elements, then it couldn't. To me, it doesn't really matter what you call those particular, the name by which those go, as long as those qualities are embodied. And I think many of the speakers, the Professor Hunt and Dr. Biddulph and Venerable Kovidao, all of us were, in a sense, alluding to that fact. It's really what you do that makes a difference. So, whether someone uses a Buddhist language or uses a sort of Christian theistic language or a psychological language, I don't think the terminology really matters. It's the qualities of being that are important. So that for some people, any kind of religiosity in the language is a sort of, is an alarm button. And so that what is known as stealth Buddhism has evolved over some time where, and I've had conversations with Jon Kabat-Zinn and others about this as well, where, say for him, see, America is a far more sort of religiously conscious country than anywhere in Europe. Even the most sort of zealously religious country in Europe is nothing like the USA in terms of, I would say, having lived there for 15 years. It's an extremely strong force in the culture. And so for Jon Kabat-Zinn to develop the mindfulness-based stress reduction as a training, he had to quite deliberately trim out all of the Buddhist language in order for it to be an acceptable therapeutic training within the pool of American society, because he knew that if it had any kind of religious tone to it, and it was not just presented as a mental training, that it would have been sort of dead in the water, as they say. So, because it was growing up in America, it was developed in America, then that was needed to be trimmed out. But even in Europe or other places around the world, I feel that as long as those qualities are being, say, developed, and that the view behind them, particularly what Dr. Biddulph was saying about kindness, and that's the genuine human qualities of warmth and friendliness and caring is embodied in that, then it indeed can be liberating. It's not just a sort of a superficial training, but I feel as long as those qualities are present, then it doesn't really matter what you call it. That's my opinion.
The with regards to that, I mean, when it comes to our practice in all, whatever religion, there is always this central figure that we see. How important, Achan, do you think that central figure is to a person's life when it comes to getting down to the practice, motivating yourself to sit down every day or meditate, to be more compassionate, to be more kind? Or is it possible to have that same effect without that central figure notion? Because, Professor Hunt, you also did speak about this identity and not seeing that. And now, when we are able to perceive ourselves as Nama Rupa or, in that ultimate form, can we have the same results? What do you think?
Yes, this is this is a daily issue. If you're involved in teaching meditation because, you know, we have outreach classes free of charge in which 50, even 70 people have turned up. And it's an anonymous audience in the sense that you don't know really why they're there. I sometimes ask them, if I've got time, why did you come? What are you expecting? Now, you might find two or three people are there because they have tinnitus, and perhaps meditation could help with that. I say, okay, what have you got to lose? Try it. That's okay. I'm not going to say, go away, this is a Buddhist meeting, am I? Others are there because they've been doing Buddhist meditation for some time. They just want maybe to hear a different angle on it, or they just want to know what we're up to. So it's very, 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 very wide. Another problem that I run into is you get those very direct questions from some people. They sort of bounce over to you and say, are you a Buddhist? And I think part of me is saying, I don't want to be labeled. You know, the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. You know, it's about doing something. It's very practical. So you either do it or you don't. But of course, we do need to get on with the labels. We need to use labels. So sometimes, depending on who I'm talking to, some of them will say, no, not in that sense. I'm not. It's not an ideology. You know, Buddhism, alcoholism, communism, sexism. You know, and Buddhism. I don't want to belong in that category, really. But it depends to whom you're speaking, because some people will understand that, and other people won't. So they'll say, oh, so you're not a Buddhist then. so you can't win. So I generally try to get around it by saying, look, it's a practice, and if you're interested in doing this practice, and you might find yourself becoming more peaceful, more compassionate, wiser, why not? What have you got to lose? We don't charge anybody for anything. It's all free. Just come along, try it, see whether it does something for you. If it does, try some more of it. I think that was the Buddha's attitude when he was wandering about in Northeast India. I think it was probably that kind of approach. You know, what have you got to lose? Try this. But it depended a lot on to whom he was speaking. But the other questions which are trickier are, is it a religion or not? Or do you believe in the afterlife? Or do you believe in God? Now, my heart sinks when I get these direct questions. Because the main reason is that there is something wrong with the question. Mm-hmm. And you can't really enter easily into a dialogue with people that are just stopping you while they're passing by with a cup of tea. Mm. You can't really answer it because you can't really say to them, well, there's something wrong with your question. Shall we discuss the way they want an answer now. But they basically want a yes or no answer.
Yes.
So you're in a situation of being asked, like, have you stopped beating your wife? If you say yes, it means you were beating your wife. And if you say no, it means, well, you were beating your wife before then. So you were. So you know, you can't escape from it. So, and that's the situation one is in. So again, I try to filter people out. Some will respond to some kind of answers and others won't. If you start getting into the meaning of non-theism as opposed to atheism or theism, that's another tricky one, but it can be done. But it's very difficult to do it without getting into anatta and, you know, non-duality and the rest of it, because that's the background is so different, the assumptions are so different, that you would have to give quite a long talk, and then they probably still wouldn't understand it. So very often I just move people away from those questions onto one that I can answer. I don't know whether that helps us with our discussion or not, but yeah. It's a lot of what Ajahn Amaro was saying, actually.
Yes, because often people say, you know, I like what you're saying, and the meditation practice sounds really good, but the only problem, I'm not a Buddhist. And it said, well, it doesn't have, it has nothing to do with being a Buddhist. It's about the human mind. The human mind is the same. And mental problems, mental defilements, they're universal. So this is how I approach it. Yeah, and I said, it doesn't matter what you believe, but the practice, the mind training, is not about what you believe. That's right. It's something practical.
Yes. When I was listening to Achan's talk, it was very insightful, but this question sort of popped into my mind, and I'm going to drag Desmond into this as well. where we both have a mutual friend who is really into psychedelics. So he is actually planning to organize a dialogue on psychedelics, and I've been the one to be invited first. So I joke with him, are we going to try it out? So, but coming to the role of psychedelics, it's something, it's a movement, it's becoming something that people are really getting or coming into wanting to test it out. I will come to Bantha first, but if we just, in a way, enlighten mindfulness, psychedelics, people become happier, people experience states where they are able to come out of depression and anxiety in, you know, in ways that therapy couldn't do for years and years. People experiencing results with psychedelics, MDMA, LSD, within a couple of treatments. Doctor, what do you think?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question. And a lot of people got involved in Buddhism through using LSD, smoking dope, you know, and so on, because it's given them another experience, you know, and they've gone on from there to becoming, you know, actually taking the rope and, you know, going all the way through. You know, so, but the thing is, it is just the drug, and usually they realize very early on that that's all it is. You know, but it gives them a temporary state of release from the burdens of I, me and mine. And of course, if you're under the cosh of all shoulds and oughts and musts and anxiety and fear, and you smoke this thing, wow, you know, you're suddenly in a different world, you know. And then you might think to yourself, how can I make that something permanent? You know, it seems a real experience. When you stop smoking your cigarette, you just go straight back to worry, hurry, and curry, you know. And nothing has changed. So you could undertake a practice where you can make states, calm states. But not so long ago, I went to a conference at the Royal College, because I'm a member of the, I'm an emeritus member now of the Royal College of Psychiatry. But I went to a three-day conference on the use of psychedelics in the treatment of non-responsive depression. Because there are people who have really profound depression. And no matter what you give them, no matter how much you talk to them, any sort of practice you give, they just can't get better. And there is a unit at Imperial College under Professor Nutt who uses the magic mushroom, you know, which is actually psilocybin. And they do it in very special surroundings. They make a sort of slightly darkened room with beautiful music, and they light incense, and all the things that, you know, you might put on an altar, things for the eye, things for the nose, that appeal to the senses, are there, you know. And then there's two psychiatrists, sits with them, and then they take the psilocybin in different doses, and 6 hours later it's passed. They found that it had a very remarkable effect on lifting depression, which normally can't be got rid of. We have to say it's a good therapeutic response. You know, but it was very interesting in talking to people. And they do actually recognize, you know, that the state of I, this switch from everything being about I, to that I-less state, is crucial in understanding the nature of depression. That's really important, because it means that, you know, it's confirmed, at least in certain areas of the psychiatric profession, that there is such a thing of that I-less state, which gives rise to joy, happiness, enhanced experience of the world, and also, importantly, you know, a sense of profound meaning. You know, that we are here, and this experience of a human being in a human body has profound meaning and value. And that's something which is so easy to forget. You know, we forget it ourselves. And these experiences lift the depression. And that depression can be lifted for 6 months or so, and then they gradually, like a ball rolling down a hill, gradually, the depression will increase, and then they end up back at the bottom of the hill again. So they have to start again.
I don't know if that's true in all cases, but there may have been a slight shift, you know, in consciousness. But it also, I noticed that they did lots of brain testing at the same time. They put, you know, things on top of the person's head, and they put them in, you know, functional MRI, these big machines where you can see what's going on in the brain. And they noticed actually that the whole brain was activated. You know, it wasn't just normal, their normal state being depressed, or just small tracts of the brain were being used. But they found that with the use of these drugs, you know, the whole brain was suddenly involved. And actually what it really is, in part of the effect of it, is that suddenly you can actually feel, you know, people who take it, suddenly they're actually having real, genuine feelings, not just emotions of anger and rage or depression, actually feeling things, having feelings of joy, of happiness. You know, they may be sort of very forceful at times and overwhelming, but suddenly the person will come alive for the time they're actually using the medicine. But, you know, this is what, after all, what the Buddha Dharma brings to us, isn't it? If we really practice, we go from a half-dead state to becoming living human beings. You become alive through the practice of Dharma. That's the great gift. The Buddha became fully alive on his enlightenment. Sudden realization of what it is to be a real human being. That mystery answered all his problems. And this is what the Dharma teaches us. But, you know, the thing is, it's a good insight, it's a window, but it's impermanent, like all those other things. Passes, transient. But if you want to get to the deathless, then you have to undertake proper practice.
Yes, it is. It could be said that, of course, that it's a very important, impermanent thing, but yeah, the high that you experience while you are on these drugs. But when you come into things like shamanic journeying, ayahuasca, where the high lasts something like 18 hours, and in these forests people go through these experiences of shamanic journeying, it is a little bit different from what we would experience with MDMA, LSD, and all of these other drugs. It's where in shamanic journeying, it's more of going through an experience, having flashbacks of what has gone wrong, what is your hindrance, what is the barrier. And people sort of start getting these insights. And because of that, it seems that it comes to a collision in a way with morality. And, you know, is this correct? Because this is also something a drug. It is a drug. So do you have anything else to say?
Yes. In traditional societies, you know, very often the shaman, or the central spiritual figure in these, I'm taking this from maybe books that are out of date, I don't know, but the shaman was someone who probably when he was young, maybe when he was a teenager, adolescent, suddenly went perhaps mad, you know, or suddenly started to develop a psychosis, and over time gradually got better and came back into the real world, and then started being able to interpret dreams and interpret various things that were going on in the community and became a spiritual source of wisdom. Well, usually the classical features of the shamanic journey are going to heaven, heavenly states, going to hell, the hellish states, then having your body torn into pieces, often put into a sack and broken up, so it's completely fragmented. It's then brought back together again, magically, reconstituted as a human being, and then you're reborn into the world of your community. Well, you know, if you have to think a little bit about, for example, you know, the Buddha's temptations, to sort of have an understanding of that. But also you have to look at the course of a human life, you know. In order to really have wisdom, you do need to have experienced what other people experience. That's the nature of compassion, isn't it? So you need to have experienced deep depression at times, great sorrow, sadness, joy, happiness, and feelings, extreme feelings of fragmentation, coming apart and all that. And if you do a practice and you're really held together by the community and the Sangha and everything else. You will get a chance to actually, you know, through long meditation periods, to have all those experiences, but it's contained and reality is made very central to that. So you can have all those experiences. And if you can, you know, experience the full orchestra of human emotion and come back and regain your humanity in all its fullness, you know, and I don't think I need to go into what that is,
yes,
but, you know, then, you know, you can, you know, you can be compassionate to other people when they're having a terrible time. You know what it's about. You immediately know. You don't need to consult a book, or you don't need to look in a textbook or anything. You know where they are. They know where you know where it's going. You know what to tell them to do about it as well. That's the crucial thing. And the shaman, you know, was somebody where this happened spontaneously in a community. In a real religion, we somehow repeat that through the nature of the thing, because it's a natural, innate way in which we learn about ourselves, you know. And it's sort of repeated, but not. It's formalized. Language is created around it. And that gives birth, ultimately, to the fully formed human being. I think that's sort of, like that.
It is a very broad topic, to, you know, to... My bad. yes. Shall we?
So this might just be folk etymology, but I have heard that the word samana in Pali and shramana in Sanskrit is the source of the word shaman. That a shaman, a samana, you know, the monastics are samanas, and the Buddha was called the Samana Gotama, that it's the same word. So I would echo exactly what Desmond was describing, because and our teacher, Ajahn Chah, would say, if you haven't wept three times as a monk, you haven't really started the practice. That you should be confronting your... You know, you have the times of heaven, where you're deeply inspired by the teacher. It's just, it's also wonderful, it's perfect, this is just magic. This is perfect, this is just a dream come true. And then there's this moments of just grinding anguish and horror, and that's part of the training. So I would say Desmond took the words right out of my mouth, and that shamanic journey, I'm not so familiar with the shamanic tradition directly, but there's visiting heaven and hell and being broken into pieces and being reformed. What, you know, we shave our hair off, we put on these baggy robes, we reformed. That's what going forth, the going forth as a bhikkhu. That's what as a monk or as a nun, you're stripping away all your normal human characteristics. Your hair, your features, your money, your status, everything is gone. Your family is gone. Your nationality is gone. You let go. You're broken up. You're broken apart, and then you are upasampada. You're raised up into the sangha. So that the essential elements of that process are. What's contained in the monastic training. I don't make any secret of the fact that one of the reasons that I came into this life was because of experiences with psychedelics. But I also had an intuitive sense of that this is a very dangerous way to go, and I had enough friends who either went crazy, you know, took acid, LSD, and never came back alive, you know, didn't come back sane. People who within 1 year, I had four school friends who died from motorbike and car crashes, suicides, in 1 year, just in my early years of bhikkhu life. So it's an extremely treacherous territory. And I was asked the same question by one of my fellow monks a few weeks ago, and he said, what do you think about psychedelics? And I said, well, if you're driving a car and you got pulled over by the police, and what the police would say about your state of mind while you're driving the car, that, you know, you're not safe to drive a car, then it's definitely against the fifth precept. Now, the kind of situation that Desmond is describing, I feel also that's extremely important. You know, someone who has incurable depression, that can't be treated with chemicals, it can't be treated with, like, specific kind of electroshock therapy. It can't be treated with any kind of talking cure. Nothing can reach it. But if something can, great. For that person, and I've known some treatments for depression that other people were using, not with psychedelics, but other specific methodologies. They only had a very small group of experimental subjects, just like six subjects. But they said for four of those subjects, some of them said they had never experienced any kind of happy feeling in 20 years. Nothing. Not a moment of happiness in 20 years. And this was with putting an electrode right into a particular cluster of cells in the brain and with a very specific stimulation to a certain brain area. And for those people, it's like, it's like breathing for the first time in 20 years. So you can't say that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And if people are using psychedelics to bring that kind of experience about, well, sadhu. But then also I feel that then what do you do with it? Because you can't rely on that. That is not something that's going to be intrinsically liberating. So I feel that there's been a lot of talk in Buddhist literature recently about psychedelics and their value and such like. And I'm extremely cautious, and I certainly wouldn't recommend it, because the number of people that are sitting down in an extremely carefully controlled situation, just like if you're in the dentist, you know, being given nitrous oxide in the dentist chair, it's safe. You're sitting still, you're kind of held down, and you're having, and nitrous oxide is a psychedelic, I can assure you. But you're in a dentist's chair and you're under medical supervision. You're not driving a car, you're not sitting in a room with friends, you're not even kind of walking through the woods on a retreat. You know, that kind of close, caring, knowledgeable supervision is non-trivial. That's an important part of it. So I certainly wouldn't recommend that as a path. Obviously I'm biased, you know, I'm a monk, and so that's my conditioning, but I would say that it's extremely treacherous. Also, in terms of the shamanic world and people who've had those kind of visionary experiences, encounters with other entities, I have had personal experience of being with people and counseling people who've made those kind of bonds with non-material entities who then can't unbond themselves. You know, and that there's sort of going on a ayahuasca journey and meeting your ancestors or meeting your spirit guides, it's not always benign. And if you study some of Carl Jung's experiences and many other people in the psychological field, that it's extremely treacherous. And that I personally, I would not recommend that path, because of the dangers and the sort of irreversibility, because in terms of greed, hatred, and delusion, greed and hatred have got sharp edges. They're fairly clearly defined. When the mind gets lost in delusional states and the self-deception and not being having clear boundaries of what to believe or what's true or what's not true, I would say that moha is almost the most dangerous of the three unskillful roots, because I'm not saying that greed and hatred are great, but they're clearly defined. And when the mind gets lost in delusional states, it's extremely difficult,
yes,
to be clear about what the boundaries are, or what is trustworthy, what's not trustworthy. And those who are lost in delusion and self-deception are much, much harder to live with, to work with, and to teach, and than the other types of unskillful mental state.
Yes, Bhante. I think that's very clear. So in any way, we are not in any accord motivating you in any way, just to be clear. Yes, of course.
Question. Do you think that sometime in the future, in principle, we could just abolish Buddhism? We don't need it. just physical interventions in the brain, if you had enough knowledge, we'll just make the physical interventions. Everybody will be happy when they run. What's the point of Buddhism? Now, this is what they call a reductio ad absurdum question, right? It's meant to challenge you as to something going wrong with our thinking here. The other side of that coin is that we're here because the Buddha was a genius of some sort, and he taught us a lot of things, and it's all written down. At that time, 2,500 years ago, which is the Iron Age, he knew absolutely zilch about how the brain worked. And yet, he has given us instructions and a direction in life which has stood the test of time, 2,500 years, and we're still here. He didn't know anything about brain science, and yet hasn't. Is there something deficient? This is the question. Is there something deficient in the Buddha's teaching that will be filled by neurology? That's the other side of that question.
Yes.
I just wanted to mention that in Canada, I know someone who did a lot of these ayahuasca events, and he went to Peru to be with a shaman, like a retreat. So he did several of these shamanic journeys. But in the end, he realized that he wasn't having any wisdom. He had incredible visions, but they were impermanent, and the deep understanding of who he really was missing. So he went back to Dharma practice. And just to mention about depression, one of the reasons why I do Qigong sessions, of some of you know, because it's a form of mindfulness, it's a dynamic, it's very simple, and it's good for releasing stress, emotional stress, and it deals with anxiety and depression also.
Thank you, Bhante, thank you. In a moment's time, we are going to be opening the session up to the audience. So if you do have any questions, think of them, keep it with you. But I'm going to ask one more question before we move on to giving the chance to the audience. We speak about mindfulness, we speak about, and in Buddhism it's the concept of anatma, non-self, is a predominant factor in our development, which is very pivotal to our understanding and vipassana. But many people, from a very young age, we question ourselves on who I am. And then in the mindfulness, we go to a place where that identity is questioned. You know, is there a person here? Is there someone actually called I, myself, me? Of course, we know in Buddhism it says, no, clearly there is no you. This is a components, elements which comes together. But how beneficial is that attribute, that science, that knowledge to a person who is trying to live a lay life, a person who is going to sort of, might be doing mindfulness just for bliss, just for happiness, just to have a good night's rest, who's not aiming for nirvana? I think I should first hand over to Professor Hunt.
I'm a little bit puzzled by the question, but I am reminded that somewhere in the Pali Canon, I can't quite remember where, the Buddha confronts the questions that people ask about what am I, what was I, where will I be, etc. And he says, don't waste your time with these questions. They will not help you in the least. In fact, they are muddled questions again. So many questions are unanswerable simply because they're muddled questions. And the Buddha could see that, which is part of his genius. So, but you see, this is a question at different levels. If somebody's asking, "What am I meaning? Should I be a doctor, or should I be a dentist, or should I become an Antarctic explorer?" Well, okay, that's a very specific sort of question. But we're asking a question about human identity. It's what we call an ontological question, a question about our reality as human beings. Now, that question cannot be answered in the form, what am I? The answer to it is in following the Noble Eightfold Path. And when you've done that, then you will see what is wrong with the question.
Yes. If we elaborate on the part where it's about, okay, am I a real doctor? Am I this person? Am I, you know, where a person tries to find a calling in life, basically.
Yeah, what, that's a mundane question.
That is a mundane question. But that mundane question also gives us some sort of a standing in what kind of life I would lead.
Yeah. Can I make an attempt to answer that? Yeah. Wait, you know, resilience is a word which is used a lot now in psychology. So resilience is the capacity for something to bounce back to its original shape. You can imagine with a ball, can't you crush a ball and just rub a ball, it goes back to its original shape. Human beings are not like a rubber ball. They're quite complex. And if they're squished, they can stay squished. But you know, the practice allows about that squishedness to go back. If someone says, Desmond, you're useless, hopeless, doctor, I can go get squished, you know. I might spend days trying to get over it. Yes. I feel it as I say it.
You actually turned red.
Yes. Anyway, you understand what I mean, don't you? You do. You know, but there is something inside one that really knows that's not the case. But it's getting very familiar with that side of one. And that's really the thing that the Buddha was always pointing towards. It's not I. It's that other side that's always there, always present, always listening, always seeing, always happy, actually. But it's making contact with that, staying in contact with it as long as possible. If you have done something wrong to someone, of course you have to say, I'm so sorry. I really made a mess there, you know. And it has to be meant too, otherwise you won't feel better. And you won't bounce back and become back to normal. You'll still feel something's wrong. So, you know, all those things are actually natural. But where it connects with other people is that this resilience, you know, which is, I may think of as personal, this capacity to go back into its original form, also takes place in a football team. You hear people saying, you know, Arsenal, they just lost their form. Look at what happened in the second half. They all lost their form. They're all over the place. I mean, you know, so form, you know, this structure, the capacity to keep a structure, is very, very important. If something happens in a family, something bad, the family loses its harmony and its form, and it'll wobble and may even collapse and die. You know, the whole thing may just break up. You know, when we say, you know, I give homage to the Sangha, venerable in its harmony, it's talking about that resilience. You know, if something does go wrong, because there's no I there, it immediately goes back to its original form. The form isn't lost, you know, the harmony is there, harmony is present. So the identity is to do with all the non-I things, like, you know, the harmony, the joy, the happiness, and the capacity to deal and say yes to all the unhappy things. And that's one's identity. It's not, you know, whether I'm a boy or a girl, or whether I'm big or small, as it is in the Metta Sutta, thin or fat or whatever it is, it's to do with that living thing, you know, which is always pointing towards. But people do get very upset about identity. It's one of those big things. And why? Because we're encouraged by partly our socioeconomic thing. You've got to be a somebody. You've got to be a someone, you've got to be appreciated, you've got to have self-esteem, build up your self-esteem, build up your confidence, build up your this, build up your that. You know, what about just learning just to be natural, you know, that's important. But it's when it comes to being, say, choosing a profession, well, you obviously have to go with things that you're interested in, things that the heart inclines towards, things that the heart moves to, things that really interest you and absorb you. Move towards that, give your heart to that, see where that will take you. I remember somebody asked one of my teachers, he said, well, say, you tell me to give my heart to something, to what I'm doing right now, you tell me to do that, but say I'm going in completely the wrong direction. tell me to give heart to what I'm doing right now in the here and now, and I'm going this way, but I really should be going that way. What do I do about that? He said, don't worry. The road will bend. You give yourself that way, and it will bend and go right the way around, the way you need to go. So the thing is, if you give your whole heart to the here and not what you're actually doing, whatever it is inside that needs to be activated, it comes alive. Come alive will carry you and take you where you need to go.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Thank you. So, who has any questions? If you put your hands up, yes.
I mean, I'm really lucky to have been listening to this whole seminar. I'm very thankful to Professor Sila Vimala Amru for that. And I want to ask a question from Professor Desmond.
Mm.
He concluded his lecture saying, feel it, feel it. He said about depression. Yeah, you concluded your lecture saying that to feel it. That means you said the desires, and not to suppress the desires, but to feel it.
Yes, so that is an incredibly important. That's a very, very important question, because a lot of people think when they go into religious practice, spiritual practice, they mustn't feel desire. You know, it says desire is the cause of all this. Therefore, I will not feel desire. You know, I'm going to just block it out. So they become more and more stiff and more rigid. But that's not what the Buddha said, you know, not at all. It's not to do with that. It's the object of this thing is to feel things fully, but not give in to them. You know, I'm very thirsty. That glass of water will become incredibly important. All I'll be able to think about is drinking that water. You can imagine, can't you, a very hot day. Can I take that desire? Am I able to endure it? To endure that suffering? If I could? Yes, I can. It's only going to be another 10 minutes. And I have my drink of water, 15 minutes. But if I snatch it, you know, and I drink it down now, then I cause upsets everybody, doesn't it? So feeling that desire, then if I feel, know what it's like to be really thirsty, I'll know what it's like for you to be really thirsty. And furthermore, that thing inside me that always wants to have its own way will have been just gentle, just that little bit. It hasn't given in. So just that little bit less of me. Because I've been able to say no. Is it, do I say no just because you're looking at me, and therefore I'd be embarrassed if I grabbed it? But when you've gone out of the room, then I'll grab it. No. You know, I mean, that can be a reason. It's not a bad one. But it's not, it won't ultimately do it for you. It's important to realize the real importance of that sustained restraint. You know, how really, really important that is. And something inside us really does understand that. You may think these rules are imposed from the outside, but there is something very deep inside human beings that really understand the nature of restraint. And if you can do, and it's linked to kindness and generosity, strangely enough, there's a very strong link and tie between those two things. But it's not just desire that we need to also feel strongly and deeply. It's all the emotions need to be known, you know, because then they become the guides, don't they, to life. They tell us what's going on, spot on. If we really know ourselves, we really know all our little tricks, all little things we get up to all the time, you know, then we can see them very clearly in other people. But unless the compassion is there, then it becomes just judgmental. And where we end up being unkind to others and getting rigid ourselves, and that's That's not the Buddha way at all. But to really experience full knowledge, know you make mistakes, you do give in occasionally, but, you know, come back to it again and again.
Any other?
Hello. Yes, I'd also like to express my deep gratitude to the panel and to Venerable Sila Wimala. It's been an amazing event. I've got quite a basic question, I think, in some ways, or fundamental, which is, can somebody speak to the difference between attention and mindfulness? So the definitions, the Western definitions of mindfulness often mention attention. In the Abhidhamma, I believe there's sati and I think it's manasikara. Yeah, and one is described as, I think sati is a beautiful mental factor, whereas manasikara is a universal. And perhaps somebody could say something about that.
Achan, could you?
So attention, manasikara, is the mind being placed on a particular object. So just as we were talking about the role of sila, and mindfulness, I would say, has an intrinsic, if it's sati, genuine sati, will always have an ethical element within it. There's always the element of sila. It's a beautiful state. It's attuned to Dhamma, to some degree, greater or lesser extent. So that sati on its own has an ethical element. Sati sampajanya has an ethical element and is also attuned to the time, the place, the situation. So it's an informed mindfulness. And then the most refined kind of sati is satipanya, or mindfulness conjoined with wisdom. So that's the sense, the mindfulness of not only are you hearing these words, not only are you aware of the fact that it's nearly time for the session to finish, but also you're aware of the fact this is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, happening in your mind, and that all of these patterns of experience are anicca, dukkha, anatta. So it's like a holistic mindfulness. Attention is a sort of morally neutral quality. So just as the attention that is needed by the bank robber and the snipers that Desmond was eloquently talking about, the Hatton Garden robbers, they thought a certain amount through very carefully, but apparently the discussion in the pub was what got them in trouble. It was rejoicing over a few jars, that discussing how they pulled off this massive heist, that was their downfall. Thus have I heard. The actual robbery was done with a lot of attention, and so that paying of attention is manasikara, is the mind being put onto a particular object. So that kind of is, in a way, it's a contributing factor to mindfulness, to sati. But sati has a not just an ethical element, but it also has that quality of balancing, of integrating. So within the the five faculties, the five indriya, you have wisdom and faith that balance each other, and concentration and energy that balance each other, and sati is the one in the middle that is the kind of balancing agent. That's the pivot, the hinge for those other qualities. And so and that appears also in the description of the seven factors of enlightenment. The Buddha again describes sati, mindfulness, as the quality that integrates the rousing factors of enlightenment factors and the calming enlightenment factors. So that attention on its own doesn't have that integrative and balancing quality, whereas sati will do. So sati is more comprehensive and more automatically attuned with Dhamma. You can have, if you like, wrong kinds of mindfulness, or what they call micca sati, which is different discussion in a way. But I would say, in the normal use of the word mindfulness in terms of a Buddhist context, then it has those qualities to it. Whereas attention, manasikara, is much more kind of neutral and functional.
I'm sure you're accurate, Panthe. No questions. Would there be anyone else? Yes, Mailing. Yes.
Uh, Ajahn Amare, I was just wondering in terms of your question, your point about sila being very important. In a culture that's quite sick of religions telling you what to do and like quite a lot of drinking culture and pressure to conform, how do you approach or how do you encourage discussions about sila in those kind of skeptical contexts?
Well, it's a very good question. You're certainly not the first person to ask that. One of the analogies that I like to use is like the use of sila is like the using brakes on a car. You don't need the brakes all the time, and you know if you only had the brakes and you didn't have an engine or an accelerator, you couldn't really get any place. But in order to get from A to B, you need the brakes along the way. You can't drive a car safely in any circumstances, really, if you haven't got brakes to slow you down when you need to. So it's exactly that function. And so that just as someone wouldn't consider trying to drive a car with no brakes on it, and they wouldn't be able to do legally, similarly, that it's a practical consideration with respect to sila. And that you don't have to put it into religious language. You can talk about it in terms of your own well-being. You can refrain from drinking alcohol, not because you want to climb on a high horse and judge other people, but just you can quite honestly say, I don't like to do that to myself, or it's not a state of mind that I enjoy. To be quite honest about that. And some people, they kind of use slightly deceptive speech. So they might say something like, my liver. They don't say there's anything wrong with their liver. They just say, my liver. I wouldn't encourage that. I think it's much more important to be honest and straightforward. I think we teach by example. So rather than feeling you have to explain everything or to sort of go into a theoretical exposition about why it's good to keep the precepts, but just how you are in yourself. Like I was saying about Abhaya Dana, just the fact that people trust you, people respect you, people like to be around you, people feel safe, close to you. Just that in itself, that speaks for itself. And so that if you jump in with an explanation and try to be convincing, then you make yourself more off-putting and irritating. So just being the way you are and letting the benefits of living in a respectful, kindly, harmless way, let that have its own message. And rewinding a little bit to the point about, I think the Venerable asked about, if you just want to have a comfortable life, how does that relate to not self? It's kind of connected. So if you have a practical and natural approach to sila, that is just a way of doing yourself a few favors in life. And similarly with the teaching on not self, if you really want to enjoy your life, you really want to kind of just be comfortable and be, able to enjoy things, don't think about yourself. Don't live a self-centered life, because the more you think about yourself, the more depressed and anxious and agitated you'll be, the more miserable you make yourself. So to just let go of self-centered attitudes, not because of a deep philosophical principle, but just because if you think about yourself all the time, if you get self-obsessed, self-centered, you create more alienation, more insecurity, and more sort of discord between yourself and others. So that if we are able to let our life be sort of nature-centered rather than self-centered, just to that anatta is not some kind of weird remote philosophical principle, but is living simply, living naturally, and living in a way that's not obsessed with you having things the way you like all the time, but like Desmond was saying about being resilient, or robust is a word I like. You find yourself, if you're comfortable, you're okay. If you're uncomfortable, you're okay. If you're hot, you're okay. If you're thirsty, you're okay. If your stomach's full, you're okay. That kind of easefulness in yourself and not having everything based around your own comfort and your own preferences, that makes you able to really enjoy your life. And then that kind of natural ease within yourself, that makes your own life comfortable, and also it communicates itself to the people around you.
Yes. So we've actually come to the end, unfortunately. Unfortunately, we've come to the end. It's like it brushed 1 hour. But I would just like to ask one more question, which I think would be very important to all of us who are here. In the practice, we find many people who sometimes want to keep themselves, are not very open. They rather prefer to keep things inside. And then we have mindfulness, we have meditation, which goes inside. Can we reach a happier state of mind, a more balanced state of mind, without the interaction with the outside world, our friends and family, without talking our problems out? Is mindfulness just enough, or does it go hand in hand? I'm sorry, Achan.
Again, I'd refer back to what was said earlier today. I'd say as human beings, we're a communal animal. We need each other. Some of us are a bit more self-reliant, and some are a bit more sort of misanthropic. We kind of just dislike other people. But I would echo again what Desmond was saying. If you're in a tribe of chimpanzees, a chimp left on its own won't thrive. Or a bee in a beehive, a bee left on its own won't thrive. We're a communal animal. We need each other. And so that to a certain extent, the degree to which we are genuinely practicing mindfulness, there will be times when we'll be mindfully aware that I need a friend. Or I can help a friend. You know, I can step out of my little bubble and I can give assistance to my companions here, because that person, you know, she's looking upset, or you know, he's looking, overstressed. I can step out of my own inner thing and reach out, because I'm connected. It's a relational practice, and that I feel that the fact that the Buddha's teaching is based around the Sangha. The Sangha is a third refuge. It's not a coincidence that means that the unified assembly. That is a refuge, is that quality of communion, that we are living together. We can live together as a human family, in communion, in a harmonious, unified state, and that's a refuge. Obviously, when we talk about the three refuges, we talk about the Sangha as a refuge, as the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, the enlightened ones. But I feel that we live in connection with each other. The Buddha was totally enlightened. He was a Sammāsambuddha, but then he lived the next 45 years completely in a state of relationship with the society. He lived on alms food. His body was nourished by the gifts of the people of Bihar and Uttar Pradesh and northeast India. He lived in relationship to others, and that sense of isolation, or I don't need anybody, you know, I'm fine by myself, that's often based on a not very subtle aversion, I would say. Yeah, and that it's not a weakness to need each other. I'd say it's a recognition of our communal qualities, like your heart needs your liver, your liver needs your lungs and your kidneys, their organs all work together as a unified whole. So I say, as a human family, and the more that we can recognize that our individual work that we do on ourselves is connected. We affect others around us, and others affect us. And if we do the best we can with our own life, that's not just a blessing for us as individuals, but it's a blessing for everyone that we live with.
So this marks the end of our session. Thank you, Chan. Thank you very much for letting me haggle you and ask you questions. So this marks the end of the discussion, and yes, and Pantakasa will be delivering the vote of thanks. Now.
My reverence to the Mahasangha. I feel most privileged to have been given the opportunity of conveying the vote of thanks at this milestone event for LBV and BMBS. The feedback has been overwhelming, and I hope that you would join me in wholeheartedly conveying our appreciation to Ajahn Amaro, Venerable Kovida, Professor Hunt, Dr. Bidalp, who have made the time to be here, support LBV and BMBS, and also for sharing their most beautiful insights with all of us here. Thank you. I may also like to express our sincere thanks to the head monk of the London Buddhist Vihara, all the resident monks, Anagarika Dharmapala Trust, the Vihara Management Committee, and all our coordinators. At the London Buddhist Vihara, we feel most fortunate to have a team of enthusiastic and dedicated supporters who have worked very hard to bring this seminar to what it has come to be today, from the printing work to managing the sound systems, to the flower arrangements, to preparing the refreshments, and all overall helping to keep everything together. Thank you all for your support. And last but not least, I would like to thank all of you, our audience here today, for being here with us all throughout the event and making this event memorable to all of us. Thank you all, and I wish you good evening and a safe journey back. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Venerable Kasava. That's enough, actually, the words from the organization. But it is customary for us to share some thanks, some customary way we share some gift with our speakers, especially as I have the overall responsibility for this event. I must be grateful to all of you, the speakers, most honorable, my Kalyan Mitra Ajahn Amaro. He accepted my invitation. Thank you so much. Wholeheartedly, I convey my grateful thanks to you, Bhante. And Bhante Kovida, thank you so much for sharing with your insight with us. And also my good friend, Dr. Desmond Bidalf, the chairman of the Buddhist Society, always with me in order to organizing important events in the past and today as well. And my good friend, Dr. Professor Jeffrey Hunt, when I had an opportunity to talk with him, then he was very kind and friendly, accepted my invitation. Thank you so much. I have a lot of problems, questions actually. I don't have enough time to chat, ask these questions because being head of the Vihara, mindfulness practice and this head monk position sometimes clash to each other. Therefore, that is, I think, we all have sometimes. You are holding some positions, but if you think there is no I and no myself and something is clash, these thoughts and the practice. Therefore, my feeling is we are actually playing our roles. We are playing our roles, not thinking and egocentric feelings. I'm doing my role. Therefore, I, for instance, I have to be tough sometimes, you know. That is not with the feeling of me and my and but awareness of the role, what I have to do. Therefore, sometimes I have these feelings. I'm very grateful when I listen to Ajahn Amaro. It's a part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Mindfulness is something more than what we practice without sila. Therefore, very much grateful, drawing our attention to sila and other factors of enlightenment. And our good friend Ajahn Kovida shared some wonderful thoughts, very wonderful thoughts, non-duality, etc. We can all deepen our insight, our experience, actually, with the help of this wonderful, it's a remarkable event. Throughout the last 10 years as head of the Vihara, this is the most remarkable day, which I feel. I have organized so many events, sometimes at the Hammersmith Town Hall, sometimes in other places. But this is the most remarkable because this is which is very helpful, useful for our day-to-day life. As Professor Hunt said, it is important with day-to-day our activities. So therefore, I am so much happy about the event. This is, some people mentioned my name. I'm very happy, but it is actually it's a teamwork. All the monks, all the coordinators, all the our VMC members have worked together. This is the results of our teamwork. Thank you very much for working together to give a good result. And the outcome will be very beneficial to all of us in future. I would like to ask to bring my cards, please. Okay.